Hello, Catskills. Welcome to the Watershed Post Half Hour News Hour.
I'm Julia Reichel.
I'm Lissa Harris.
The Watershed Post is a news hub, a bracing antidote to the idea that nothing ever happens around here in the Catskills.
Here's what we've got for you today.
We have two guests on our show today. The first one is Elizabeth Zakari, the Vice President of Clinical Services at HCR Home Care, a healthcare organization that maintains offices in Schoharie County and will soon be providing healthcare in Delaware County as well. We also have Chuck McCune, a disaster analyst and building expert, and the executive director of the PRISM Foundation, who will talk to us about flood damage.
But first, this week's headlines.
Towns across the Catskills are struggling to comply with a new law that places a 2% tax cap on budget increases. Some towns, such as Middletown and Sydney in Delaware County and Shandaken in Ulster County, are seeking to keep the town budget for the upcoming year on the same level as last year, a big zero in an increase. Other towns in the region, such as Andes in Delaware County and Olive in Ulster County, are seeking exemptions from that 2% tax cap. Across the board, it isn't easy, and there's a lot more information about that on watershedpost.com.
In Andes last week, a resident stood up in a town meeting and publicly accused the town's highway superintendent, who is up for re-election, of being unable to read. The accusation has brought turmoil to a usually peaceful small community on the eve of an unusually fraught election season.
The town of Sydney is also unusually fraught at the moment. Last Thursday, the town board voted unanimously to allow the Leatherstocking Gas Company to build a natural gas pipeline through the town. The vote occurred at a raucous town meeting where opponents of the pipeline loudly expressed their fear that the pipeline would lead to the controversial practice of hydraulic fracturing within Sydney.
The Boysville supermarket IGA reopened last Thursday to the great delight of local residents after 6 weeks of being closed due to flood damage, which one of the owners and managers estimated cost the store over $1 million. Over 2 feet of water flooded the store during Tropical Storm Irene, destroying the floor, much of the equipment, and most of the groceries inside. So we're delighted that they have reopened.
You were on hand last week when the store reopened, right, Lissa?
We were both on hand.
I know, it was a rhetorical fallacy right there. I was there, too.
Taking photographs and speaking to employees and delighted shoppers who who once again had their fix of groceries without having to drive all the way to Kingston for them.
At least in Olive.
It was pretty festive.
Another positive and yet sort of flood-related news. Margaretville resident Lauren Davis has made a large donation to Clarkson University, his alma mater, in northern New York to establish a new program on research into stream management. Locally in Margaretville, Davis is famous, or perhaps notorious, for his dispute with the village of Margaretville over the management of the Binnakill Stream, a small stream that flows out of the East Branch and through the center of town and whose bulkhead sits on Davis's property.
Part of this program is going to involve Clarkson University students and faculty and researchers doing research on stream management in the Catskills. So
on the Binnakill?
I don't know, but we'll find out. We're gonna keep an eye on that, and hopefully you'll read more about that on the Watershed Post. Finally, it has been an interesting week about road signs in the Catskills. Alert readers sent us a photo of a sign in Fleischmann's, which is almost 100 years old and describes the highway as the Higway, and also a series of signs on Route 28 that feature a skier apparently skiing either straight up into the air or straight down rear end first. It's hard to tell which direction that guy is going. We hear from our correspondent Aaron Bennett, though, that one of those skiing signs has already been fixed after a complaint to the DOT.
Just to be clear, those skiing signs are DOT-installed signs on Route 28 that are leading travelers along the Route 28 corridor to various ski centers in the Catskills. And it's really funny. They don't look wrong.
Well, and there are several of them, and they are all installed that way. So
yeah, they just thought maybe...
The guy's just skiing straight up
into the air. He's facing uphill. It's very strange.
Anyway.
So those are our top stories across the Catskills
for this
week.
Clearly earth-shattering news.
And we're gonna cut short our headline section because we really want to talk to both our guests. So those were our headlines. During the flooding caused by Hurricane Irene, the offices of HCR Home Care in Schoharie were destroyed, along with much of the rest of the village's infrastructure. Schoharie is the county seat of Schoharie County, and it is not a pretty sight, even 6 to 8 weeks after the flooding. HRC mobilized much of its nursing staff to attend flood survivors in local shelters and was actively involved in the recovery effort. Today, we finally get to talk to Elizabeth Zakari, the Vice President of Clinical Services at HRC, who was very active during the flooding and in the aftermath. aftermath. She's with us on the phone. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, how are you?
Wonderful. It's wonderful to have you. I wish that we could have talked to you during the flood, and I know we tried to set that up, and just we couldn't make it happen on our end. So we'd love to hear about it.
I have to say all of us in Rochester, especially at HCR, have been thinking about our friends and colleagues in that area, and even still hearing how people are helping and what the need is, and we're actually anxious to help in any way we can.
Well, can you tell me a little bit about what happened, especially in Schoharie, but sort of from your perspective during last month's flooding?
Well, we started to hear from our employees that are located in an office in Schoharie about the potential flooding. We went into our emergency plan, which is part of what a home health agency has to do in order to anticipate a threat of any sort to our patients and patient care delivery. And so we were, waiting to see just how this was going to evolve. And of course, as you know, it evolved very quickly into a disastrous situation. And within 2 days, we were talking with representatives from the county about their urgent need for assistance in the organization of and the staffing of their shelters for the general public. At the same time, we were working closely with our own employees and leadership in Schoharie to better understand where all of our patients and employees were and whether or not they were affected. So it was really two-pronged, our conversations and our involvement, one being our own employees and our own patients in ensuring their safety and that care needs could be met, but also in terms of supporting the larger community. And we mobilized very rapidly a number of people from our Rochester office as well as our Cortland office and sent nurses and administrative staff down to assist in any way possible. And they were really prepared to do anything the county wanted them to do. Primarily, we were taking our direction from the public health director, mm-hmm. who was brand new. I mean, that was baptism by fire for her, because I believe that she had not even really formally started her role in the county and was orienting herself.
Wow.
So it certainly is a testament to her flexibility and ability to respond very quickly to a significant emergency in the county. What we saw, and I will say, the HCR employees here in Rochester, most of the people who went were actually individuals that were on vacation or that work weekends and were willing to go down during the week. And they just showed a tremendous amount of compassion for the people down there. And that's very typical of nurses and community health nurses. It's part of their blood in order to respond. They know they have the skills to work in any environment. And so it was pretty easy for them to decide to just go. And in fact, some of them actually took family members so that those family members could help in other volunteer ways. The greatest need initially seemed to be organizing volunteers in the shelter in terms of scheduling the type of personnel that was needed. And in some cases, nurses were needed because there were some medical needs within the shelter. And then,
this is the Cobleskill shelter? Which shelter was this that you were mainly mobilizing people?
Primarily, we're at the shelter in Cobleskill.
Okay.
The Golding School.
Yes, that's the main one, from what we understood.
Yes, it was. And there was some minor involvement with another one down in the Gilboa area.
Mm-hmm. Elizabeth, can you talk a little bit how it was to be trying to get health care out to people in a really critical time while your own offices and your own employees had been really affected by the floods?
Yeah, that's always a challenge, and it's part of what we do as a home care agency to anticipate those problems the best we can through our emergency planning process. And our nurses were displaced immediately. Our office, unfortunately, was destroyed. We lost everything on Main Street and were not able to return to that office at all. We've relocated our office to Cobleskill. But the nurses know their patients and know which patients needed more urgent care, which patients had more family support, or whose medical needs were of less significant nature and could wait for nursing intervention. Our nurses, fortunately, were not personally affected in that none of them lost their homes or had major damage to their homes, which was helpful because it kept them in position to just continue to try to operate as best they could through the patient care. And they went out and identified all of their patients' whereabouts, some of whom had been displaced from their homes. And so when they recognized, you know, that based on address or location that they would not find a patient at home, they had to go seek information about those individuals. They did check various shelters, found some patients there, called, if they could, reach other family members to find out that they may have relocated with a family. And within a couple of days, we had identified all of our patients were indeed safe either at home or with family or in a shelter where they could continue to receive care.
How were your nurses communicating with staff and with the patients? Was it mostly by phone? The phone line still worked for the most part?
Some did and some didn't. And in some cases, they just got in their car and tried to reach a home and make a decision that way.
During the flooding, I mean, Schoharie Valley was still really kind of an iffy territory for those first couple of days.
There were many road closures.
Was your stuff getting around?
Some areas were not passable. I know that in a couple of cases they worked with the National Guard to get into an area to check on a patient. They did identify that there was one patient who was not, that they did make contact with, but could not reach because all roads leading to this home were blocked, and the patient was isolated but was determined to be safe where he was with family in place also in that home. And they just kept in contact until they could reach him, but did identify that he was safe, he had food, he had water, and necessary supplies.
I want to remind our listeners that our guest is Elizabeth Zakari, who is the Vice President of Clinical Services at HCR Home Care, based in Rochester, but working in Schoharie County through the flood last month.
And soon to be working in Delaware County, right?
That's correct. We are.
Yeah, yep. I wanted to ask you a question about that, too. It's not directly flood-related, but has the flooding and especially the destruction of some of your infrastructure changed or impacted your rollout in Delaware County at all?
No, not at all.
Great.
You know, and we're fortunately we're very flexible. We have a team of people who can work regionally and go wherever we need them to go, and that certainly played out really well in Schoharie. I think one of the ways, you know, we could be really helpful was there was quite a loss of medical supplies in the county. And so a couple of our nurses drove up to, I want to say it was Amsterdam, to go to medical supply companies up there, and were in the process of bringing back a considerable amount of medical supplies to actually put at the shelter. And they, because of road closures, they could get there, but then they couldn't get back, and that's where the county personnel director, I believe it was, put us in touch or contacted someone at the National Guard who said they would fly the nurses and the supplies back to the area. So they actually sent a helicopter up to Amsterdam and picked up the nurses and the supplies. But I have to really commend those nurses because at the time, you know, things needed to happen and needed to happen quickly. And given the fact that the county was displaced from their offices, there was no way to follow protocol and try to get a check request to go get equipment. And these nurses just pulled out their credit cards and pretty much maxed them out buying medical supplies for the county shelter. And, you know, it was just a testament to them as people, as residents of Schoharie County, as well as nurses.
Elizabeth, thank you so much for being with us today, and please stay in touch as we go forward.
Well, I am thinking about all of you, and I especially at the radio station there, because I was a guest at the Roxbury across the street, and I was thinking, hoping that their beautiful motel was preserved.
Well, immaculately, in fact.
We were there just the other day. And
and our second guest stayed there last night, so he can give you a detailed report.
I'm so happy to hear that and that your station was safe as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank those nurses for us, because that's a truly wonderful service they provided.
Many, many unsung acts of heroism were performed.
Absolutely. I'm sure you've seen evidence of that all throughout those counties.
Yeah, it's good to mention it. Thank you so much for joining us, Elizabeth.
You're very welcome.
You're listening to the Watershed Post Half Hour News Hour from WIOX 91.3 FM. Now we turn to our second guest, Chuck McCune. He's a building expert and a disaster recovery expert who runs an organization called the PRISM Foundation, which advises citizens in the wake of natural disasters. He has spent some time in Haiti and in post-Katrina New Orleans, and now he's visiting the Catskills. Thanks for joining us, Chuck.
You're welcome. Glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the work of the PRISM Foundation and what you hope to accomplish up here.
Well, it's PRISM Foundation, P-R-I-Z-M, and you can check us out at McCunePRISM.com. And I've been touring through the areas and making damage assessments and seeing what compares and what doesn't compare with what we've seen in other flood and disaster areas. And what's interesting here, you have both V-zone flood waters, that velocity of waters that took buildings out, and then you also had inundation.
What does V-zone mean?
Velocity zone. It means... where you have forceful water coming down very, very fast. It comes in fast and goes out fast, but it takes cars, trees, and other buildings as debris and battering rams, not unlike a tsunami situation where they take other buildings down as well. And there are ways to prevent that from happening in your recovery and rebuilding efforts, and that's also some of the things that we do is we make recommendations on how to rebuild.
Can you talk a little bit about what you've been seeing as you've toured through the Catskills, through your eyes as somebody that is looking towards recovery and towards how to do better disaster prevention in future?
Well, it's always very sad to see it, and it's also very easy but not appropriate to make comparisons to other disasters because everyone has an individual experience, and there's a story for every person, and people get individually affected by things. But what I've seen in terms of the necessary rebuilding that needs to come is that people need to think about elevating their buildings. A foot or two above flood water that they had, a foot is okay, a two is better. Orientation of the buildings. If you see a building that's been spun around, it's always point towards the water force. So that's how you should rebuild, in using your building systems to deflect the water rather than take it full force, just straight ahead. And in nature, we need to look to those systems that do that, trees that bend instead of break. And it's not hard to build a building to resist those forces. Sometimes you have to spend a little more money on the foundations, but if you shrink the foundation and build up, make a smaller footprint, you can often accommodate for the extra cost of that engineering and construction work. And then build above in a survivable area so that if you have to shelter in place for long periods of time, you've got the ability to do that. You can also deflect floodwaters with topography, and everyone who's skied knows about avalanche breaks and divides, and they're like a snowplow inverted up on the side of the hill, and that's what needs to happen in the topography in towns where they, if they can, topography allowed, divert the water around the buildings and make it less. If you're sandbagging, it's too late. You don't have to get to that kind of panic activity if you rebuild properly.
And now we're talking about rebuilding. This is in some ways an easier proposition for buildings that have been completely destroyed. But
it is.
What do you think about, or do you have recommendations for how people should be thinking when we're dealing with buildings that may have major structural damage but are not, they haven't been destroyed and that are really, you know, they house important businesses or they are part of the historic character of the town?
In New Orleans, we saw a lot of that where some folks were wishing they'd get the 51% destruction so they could clear the building out, and others, you know, were asking FEMA not to destroy their buildings or the town officials to destroy their buildings. It's a tough situation when you have a building that has generally fiberglass insulation that gets soaked, and by the time you get your insurance adjuster there to analyze the building, the mold has just taken over and it's really, really unhealthy and dangerous to be in the building.
We've seen that here too, that have been delays in building inspectors for post-flood.
Every system is shredded. The social fabric is shredded, the politics, the responses. Organizations like Elizabeth's with an emergency plan ahead of time will do a better job than folks that aren't ready. But I can guarantee you that she's looking at everything she had to do after the flood and modifying that program. And that's also what preparedness is about. So next time, it may take only a day to locate her patients instead of a couple days, because I'm sure she's dealing with those kinds of logistics mm-hmm. issues. Mm-hmm. As to rebuilding the buildings that are there, oftentimes diversion of the water in terms of flood control is warranted, because you're not going to get those buildings in shape to absorb water and then be submersible and recoverable afterwards easily.
The Associated Press ran an article, I believe it was earlier this week, maybe it was last week, about how long the rebuilding and even just the reimbursement process takes. It was sort of depressing because it made it seem like 6 weeks out, we've only really just begun.
There's a lot of agencies involved, a lot of levels of mm-hmm. government involved. You have village, town, county,
FEMA,
state, federal, and there's layers of red tape at each of those.
I was wondering, since you've seen other places mm-hmm. sort of go through this, what is your average timeline? What can people in the Catskills expect?
This is really, really frustrating, because you can look at a six-week insurance delay. Mm-hmm. What's really important, and I have to say that Mr. Stanley down in Shandaken was very good at this, in getting
that,
everything.
That would be Supervisor,
Rob
Stanley,
yes. I met with him this morning, and he's a very modest guy. I liked him right away. But he mentioned that he didn't deserve much credit, that he was just being a Boy Scout. And the motto for Boy Scouts is being prepared. And so I think that that's really an important issue about this, in terms of getting the filings done as soon as absolutely possible. But in New Orleans, it looks like the Katrina happened last week, if you cut the weeds. I mean, there's 58,000 buildings still not there, and everybody's dispersed all over the country. What's available here to you is that you have a tight-knit communities, nobody's disappeared, you all connect and communicate with each other, so that's different. But you could be looking at a rebuilding process of 6 months to a year quite easily.
I want to remind our listeners that our guest is Chuck McCune. He runs an organization called the PRISM Foundation, which advises people who have survived disasters on how to rebuild.
The other issue about that rebuilding timeline is you're right up against winter. And that's all. I'm a contractor. I used to build in New York. I used to live in New York. I lived in Boysville, Shokan. My family's in Rifton outside of New Paltz. Building here is difficult in the wintertime. So it's breathing down your necks. And so that can push. That's why I said 6 months, because some people will wait to rebuild until the spring.
And will rebuilding, I mean, should you rebuild a permanent structure? Should you rebuild it as a temporary structure? I know that your for-profit company, which is this foundation, is an arm of.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not an arm, but
I'm in
both organizations, so it's related by me. So.
Right, okay. So you know a bit about what mm-hmm. you do is you sell modular structures, correct?
Mm-hmm. Well, we design and license the technology to others.
So what we do. And, you know, given that you have a financial stake in that in your mm-hmm. other company, what do you advise people to rebuild with?
Well, we like to see people use high-quality materials that are permanent. I feel it's a waste of time to do anything that's not appraisable or appreciable, because you don't build wealth by doing that. You end up in a hole. And when you're in a hole, the idea is don't keep digging. And so whether it's our buildings or anyone else's, it should be something that you, what we've designed is a room at a time kind of a thing, so that people can get in for less money initially, and then build onto it one room at a time as they become more financially able. And that's our recommendation, but there's probably a lot of recommendations.
Yeah, is this at odds with what FEMA provides? I know FEMA just trucked in a bunch of temporary housing in Schoharie County.
We designed these buildings to replace FEMA trailers prior to Katrina. We went to FEMA in 2004. And we showed them a building that goes up in 5 hours in a driveway. Mm-hmm. And that's a code-approved building that can be later lifted onto a foundation. And it's a permanent building. They liked it. They said, well, come back as a profit. And that's why we have both
mm-hmm.
situations happening. If FEMA has not endorsed our product or does not offer our product, but they've asked us for information over twice in the last year to provide more specifications on it. And we communicate with them. And if it's available, I don't know whether mm-hmm. it'll be available. But FEMA has issues like the Stafford Act, which prevents them from investing in permanent structures. Gotcha. Now, Katrina did allow for some modification of that in response to Katrina. Now they have some alternative building situations that they can look at. But trailers are still some options that they provide, but they don't do well in cold climates, mm-hmm. and they're not an appreciable situation. And they end up selling them in the areas of hurricanes later anyway, which is also not a good idea. And I'm not knocking FEMA, because I know a lot of good FEMA, the boots on the ground folks, are great, just like any local organization. Mm-hmm. But it's a big animal, and they are wrestling with that animal as well as you all are. So it's important to realize that the folks you interface with FEMA are not the folks that make all the rules. Mm-hmm. They're just trying to figure out what those rules are as they go through the process.
Mm-hmm. Can you just talk, just one last question, if you could just talk a little bit about how, what you're doing through the PRISM Foundation locally, and how you can reach out to local homeowners whose homes have been destroyed.
Well, we're offering informational meetings for preparedness, which is something that I should say is a very personal thing. If you go to ready.gov, it tells you what to do, but if you follow that, you're handing your responsibility off to another organization that may or may not understand your situation. If you are a business that depends on your computer, make sure you have an offsite backup. Make sure you've got a grab-and-go kind of thing with an external hard drive and an entire system backed up all the time. And it's very easy to drag and drop your files on a website server that you manage yourself. It's like having another folder, but it's, you know, in the Caribbean or something, and it's not going to get a Hurricane Irene flood. But also have a go bag. But also look at everything you do in your day, everything, and make a list of it. How would you do it if you had to leave? If you had to shelter in place for a long time, a cell phone works fine inside of a sandwich bag. Have those bags in your go bag, because oftentimes communications is the most, as someone was talking about, Elizabeth was talking about earlier, the communications got lost. Communications is one of the most important things, and if your cell phone gets wet, you're not talking to anybody. So
if you're even lucky enough to have cell phone service.
Well, and that's another thing. For you guys to pay normal prices for cell phones and have the kind of service you got, there needs to be some more towers.
Chuck, I
have to stop you there because we have a couple more things we have to get to before our time is up. But thank you so much
for
joining
us. I should mention that we're going to be working in a collaborative effort with the town of Shandaken, and there will be links on their website. And Rob Stanley is our point person there. And I'll be doing one of our preparedness informational seminars at the log home down in Boysville on Thursday at 2.
We will be keeping track of that, so stay in touch with us. Thanks so much, Chuck.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me, and good luck to you all.
The political season is ramping up, and there are Meet the Candidates events across the region this week. Meet the Middletown Supervisory Candidates Forum, sponsored by the Catskill Mountain News. And WIOX is being held on Monday on October 24th at the Arkville Fire Hall and will be broadcast live by WIOX at 7 p.m. The Watershed Post is sponsoring Meet the Candidates forums in the town of Olive this Saturday at 10 a.m., moderated by the League of Women Voters of the Mid-Hudson Valley. And we are also sponsoring a forum in the town of Andes on Sunday at 1 p.m. at the Andes Hotel. That forum will be moderated by Reverend Steve Swanson and town resident Jack McShane.
It's Cider Week in New York City. This is the first annual Cider Week, sponsored by the Apple Project, an effort to revitalize traditional cider making in New York State. So across New York City, they're featuring tastings of hard and soft cider, dinners, Meet the Cider Maker events, and general festivity. So check out the Apple Project. If you Google Apple Project, you will find their information.
If you're not a political animal, the second annual Phantom Fest might capture your attention this weekend. It's a mountain bike race in costume on Saturday, October 22nd at 4 p.m. at the Renegades Mountain Bike Club in Ellenville.
The fourth annual Pumpkin Festival is scheduled for this Saturday throughout the village of Schoharie. There will be entertainment, contests, food, hayrides, pony rides, and of course there will be pumpkins.
There will also be free tarot card readings by psychic Lily, who moonlights as reporter Lillian Brown. She sometimes writes for us, actually, at the Andes Hotel this
We need to start
Saturday.
Getting her to write about the future, because it would be good to know.
I had no idea she was a psychic. Yeah, I wish she had told us.
An exhibit of aerial photos of Delaware County towns taken from the air. That would be the definition of aerial photos. Will be on display this Saturday at 678 Main Street in Hobart, and there will be a wine and cheese reception for photographer Cornell Veerlon at 4 p.m.
These events and more are featured in our This Weekend column, watershedpost.com/thisweekend.
You're listening to the Watershed Post Half Hour News Hour on WIOX 91.3 FM. And now it's time for our weekly news poem, inspired by the signs for skiing on Route 28, which are rather interesting.
All right, what kind of poem is it this week, Lisa?
It's a limerick.
The best kind.
Traditional.
Hit me.
There once was a skier from Gotham who spurned all advice that was taught him. His technique was fine, but he learned from a sign, and he went down the hill on his Botham.
That wraps up.
I can hear the groaning all around the valley.
I was trying to stifle mine. Off the hills. Could you tell? That wraps up with the horrible bang, this week's edition of the Watershed Post Half Hour News Hour.
The Watershed Post Half Hour News Hour originates from the studios of WIOX 91.3 FM in Roxbury, New York. Our technical guru is Mike Teitelbaum. Our theme music is by Fred Harris of Elephant Company in Delhi. The cheesy banter is all ours. Please join us every Wednesday at 1 p.m. right here at WIOX 91.3 FM and at 3 p.m. on WGXC 90.7 FM.
WatershedPost.com, the source for news and information in the Catskills.